This is episode number 120 of Library of the Living Dead. You are welcome here. Hello, good librarians, and welcome to episode number 120 of Library of the Living Dead. I'm so sorry it's taken 3 months to get a new podcast out. I've had some health issues, and I'm better now. So, we're going to start trying to put out a podcast each and every week, or every couple of weeks. It depends on how soon I can get them done. What you got coming up in this episode was Zombie, that you just heard, this little bit of intro, and then a letter by Zombie Survivor, a song by Bad and Rad called Zombie Bitches. And then we get Tonya Brown's Lucky Stiff, Chapter 2, Part 2. We get another song by Angie and the Car Wrecks called Zombie Creatures. And then Calvin A. Miller's Zombies Survival Guide. There's another song, Zombie, by Holocaust Haters. And then Lori Titus, Lazarus, Part 1. And then we're going to go out with a song by the Groove Barbers called Zombie Jamboree. I'm so very glad I'm back. I hope you are too. Hey ho, let's go!
Give me some ammo for my shotgun. I ain't got no time to last very long. Oh, the lonely days are here, I've been staying at home. My baby, she wrote me a letter. I don't care how many of those things I gotta kill. I just can't leave my home again. Oh, the lonely days are here, I've been staying home. My baby, she wrote me a letter. She wrote me a letter, said it was a letter from the dead. People, don't forget my words, my baby's undead. Anyway, give me some paper and a pencil. I still got all those things to kill. Oh, the lonely days are here, I've been staying at home. My baby, she wrote me a letter. Baby done wrote me a letter. My baby 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 wrote me a letter.
My baby wrote me a letter. My baby wrote me a letter.
My baby wrote me a letter. My baby wrote me a letter. It was a letter from the dead. My baby wrote me a letter from the dead. My baby wrote me a letter. My baby wrote me a letter from the dead. From the dead.
Welcome to the Black Empties, Letters from the Dead. This letter from the dead was found on the Library of the Living Dead forum and is by Zombie Survivor. It's entitled, Dear Dr. Stone. Dear Dr. Stone, please consider the following my letter of resignation. I believe that this will be the first of many letters that will arrive at your desk, the desk you never sit behind, the desk that is probably untouched ever since this whole emergency center was established, and will remain untouched until either the center will be dismantled or when your replacement arrives. I'm pretty sure that you'll not last very long. Staying in your own private lab, isolated from the rest of the world, can have a strange effect on people. Believe me, I know what I'm talking about. I've seen desperate men and women blowing their brains out when they found out what they contracted was still untreatable, that there was no perspective except an excruciating death and their inevitable resurrection. Not only the patients, dear doctor, but my colleagues and other doctors are acting strange as well. I cannot say I blame them. I, too, am suffering from weird thoughts and contemplations after such an overexposure with the infected, their grieving families, and the undead. A few days ago, I found my lab partner, Mr. Akiyama, with a gun pressed tightly against his temple. With a tear-streaked face, he told me that if he had to shoot another child again, he would go insane. I was able to talk him out of it, but it took some real persuasion skills. It drained me mentally, because I felt the same way as he did. In retrospect, I was also trying to convince myself that what we were doing here was right, that we were here with a purpose. We were not, like Dr. Thompson said during one lunch hour, wasting our borrowed time. We were trying to save the world. Do you understand what I'm saying? I was willing to put my mental and physical health at risk for people I did not know, never will know, and will probably die by some trigger-happy redneck that had a bit too much fun with the current situation. I'm really starting to ask myself why we're still doing this. We've been working on an effective vaccine for months, and all our efforts run down the drain when the virus mutates once more. It has mutated more times than I can count. It's almost as if it has a consciousness of its own. The working conditions are also abominable. But who am I to complain? I've seen the refugee camps where people are reduced to animals, sleeping in their own filth, fighting over their last scraps of food. Then there's also the stupid policy of yours to relocate and detain reanimated corpses. Why in the hell would you expose your people, the people whose lives you have in your hands, to such great risks? I understand the need for living subjects, but all of them? It's a miracle that no accidents have occurred so far. But I'm sure that in the not-too-distant future, the reanimated will strike back and cause another bloodbath. So yeah, I'm going to do the same thing as Mr. Thompson, Mr. Akiyama, Ms. Dearborn, and Mrs. Cooper. I'm resigning from my current position, and I'm leaving the emergency center. I'm grateful for knowing you before the shit hit the fan. You were a very dedicated doctor with a warm heart. You were also a great mentor. But now you're drowning in your own obsession of the living dead. I can only pray that you will see the error of your ways soon enough so that you may see the only logical thing to do. Saying goodbye and hoping that there will be something on the other side. Yours sincerely, Sarah Wood.
Why do you eat brains?
Brains.
Brains are.
Yes.
Why?
It makes the pain go away. I can feel myself.
Hurts to be dead.
I want.
Library of the Living Dead now presents Tonya Brown's Lucky Stiff, Chapter 2, Part 2.
Madame Sangrail's jaw dropped. Her mouth fell open, and she stood there in the early morning light and gaped at me like I had grown an extra head. And considering she had no problem conversing with a dead man, I couldn't imagine what I had said that had her so upset. "What?" I asked. She kept on gawking in silence, eyes bulging, mouth hanging open, the picture of surprise. "What?" I yelled. The madam closed her mouth and said in a very calm voice, "Tell me what you seen, exactly." "I see you light up like a fluorescent lamp when you orgasm." "How long you been able to do this?"
"Do what? I still don't know what I'm doing wrong."
She smiled. "Nothing wrong, boy. Nothing wrong at all. Now tell Sangrail, how long you been seeing the power?"
"You mean the light?"
"Well, never. Well, not until you raised me. I figured it was part of your mojo or hoodoo or whatever you call it." The madam turned away, leaving me sitting alone in the parlor as she walked to her boudoir in silence. I wanted to follow her, but suspected my best bet was to stay put. A series of muffled noises reached me from her room. Before long, the madam returned, carting a video cassette case. She opened the movie case, turning to look at me once more before loading the tape into the VCR that was hooked to the television set in the corner. And after all of this, she once again returned to my side, remote in tow, motioning for me to scoot over and share the chair. The TV lit up with a logo I knew I had seen before for a studio that sounded very familiar. We got to the movie's title before I remembered where I had seen that logo before. It was one of Mooch's favorite film companies, and Mooch's favorite films fell into the adult category. I had borrowed from his extensive library on many a lonely Saturday night. I never could work up the nerve to man up and buy my own. And sure enough, big as life across the screen were the words, "Anal Beauties, Anal Beasts, Number 6. It was my turn for some jaw-dropping, which I did, post-haste. "What?" she asked. "Can't an old lady enjoy a little porno without you getting all moody about it?" "I don't know what disturbs me more," I said, "the fact that you own a copy of Anal Beauties, Anal Beasts, or the fact that they made 6 of them."
17.
"What?"
"De up to 17. Dis just my favorite."
I smiled at the idea of her having a favorite porno. Then the show started, and my eyes bulged at the explosion of flesh and fetish. I should explain the reason Mooch favored this line of flicks was that the company specialized in what he called PWP porn. Plot? What plot? A string of sex scenes rolled one after another across the screen, and a succession of young, lithe ladies looked far too happy about getting their asses slammed by cocks so large they made my butt cheeks clench at the sight. The madam eyed me as I squirmed in place.
Calm down, boy, like you ain't never seen this sort of thing. Now, you're being a virgin I can buy. Ain't your fault you was shyer than a newborn kitten and a pen of pups. But to have your friend like Moochie and never seen a skin flick, I doubt it.
No, ma'am, I said. I've just never watched it with another person in the room, much less a woman.
I'd suspect not.
The madam pressed a button on the remote, and the film rocketed forward, sperm splashing asses at hurricane speeds. After a bit, she settled on a steaming hot image of a waifish, raven-haired beauty taking it up one end, while another dark-haired, lovely lady hovered over her, servicing the first gore orally while getting her pussy banged at the same time. Now, while I enjoyed the show, I didn't understand what the madam was playing at. As much as I appreciate it, I said, I don't think I need porn to get hard. See? I waggled my ever-ready prick at her. She wasn't amused.
Shut up and pay attention, boy.
The scene rolled on for a while with the usual director-driven grunting and humping. The slap of flesh on flesh boomed through the stereo system, underscored by a well-rehearsed moaning cries of, "Yeah, bitch, take it all." Even as orchestrated as it all was, it was still very arousing. If I weren't already stiff by nature, then the virtual nurture of the anal beauties would have done it for sure.
"Here now," the madam said, "watch this."
As the madam pointed to the screen, the actress on the bottom of the sex pile went tense, threw her arms around her lady lover, and shouted,
"Yes, make me come!"
"There," the madam said. "What do you see?"
I shrugged. "A woman paid to have sex?" "You don't see the light."
There was a twinge of disappointment in her voice.
"No, should I?"
I was hoping. The madam was cut short by a loud, satisfied groan. We both turned back to the TV, just as the topmost actress buckled against her partners. The woman's puss went nova with brilliance. Wincing, I shaded my eyes from the radiance, and behind my hand, the actress shrieked with pleasure, while downtown my cock twitched at the sound of her joy, aching to experience it with her. The madam didn't have to ask what I was seeing. She looked down at my thumping hard-on and smiled wide.
"This makes no sense," I said. "Why would I see light from you and from her, but not the other woman?"
I looked back to the screen in time to see one of the men shoot off in a sputter of sparkling lights. I winced, half because of the brightness, and half out of habit. I never did enjoy watching the almighty money shot. "And him," I added.
"Makes perfect sense to me," she said. "The first one was faking."
And she was right. It did make perfect sense. I felt kind of foolish for not thinking of it myself.
"But what is it?" I asked.
"I've seen a few of these films in my time, but I've never saw this before." As the words left my lips, I realized I sounded like a porn-obsessed loser, which wasn't far from the truth. I commenced backpedaling. Not that I've watched a whole lot of porn when I was alive, but still, the women never glowed. That much I remember.
"I'll get you in a minute, boy. Now, tell me what you see here."
Scene after scene we sat through, the madam critiquing the performances of the actors with a strange detachment that suggested she had seen this film way too many times. She took great joy in guessing when the women were faking, and with surprising accuracy. Meanwhile, I just sat back and watched the light show. Some orgasms shone like rare jewels, others like distant stars, while some put off barely enough light to register as the real deal. The whole time my cock ached to be part of it, like it was greedy for their satisfaction, for anyone's satisfaction. It was much deeper than mere physical arousal. My hand wandered to the madam's thigh again, and this time she didn't flinch.
"This making you hungry, boy?" she asked.
"It's making me something," I said, as I loosened her robe. She let the silk slip free from her shoulders.
"But is it making you hungry? Do you want to feed?"
"Yes," I said, as I lowered my mouth to her neck. "I want to feed." Her flavor exploded on my tongue like fresh rain on an arid land. The madam arched into my touch, cooing as my lips met her tender flesh. I growled, as did my stomach. Tracing my tongue down her neck, I buried my face in her cleavage. My body, my bones, my very spirit ached with the need of her nourishment. I had to have her on my cock, in my mouth, down my throat. I was ravenous for her. I could eat you alive, woman, I growled. That's the hunger, she whispered. As if agreeing with her, my stomach rolled again. When I realized what she meant, I pushed her away. It was hard, so damn hard, but somehow I managed to scramble off the couch and across the room to spare her my growing appetite. But it was useless. Even from a few feet away, I could feel her life racing through her veins, begging me to pounce on her and take it for my own. My guts griped louder as I clutched my stomach. You need to feed, she said. I don't want to be this, I shouted. Kill me or let me die again or whatever. Just don't let me. The hunger cut my words short, twisting my guts in empty pain and driving me to my knees. Let me help you, she said as she stood. Then, horror of horrors, she walked towards me. Why wasn't she running away? Get away, please. I don't want to hurt you. Her low laughter soothed me, but it wasn't enough. Hurt me. Boy, if you ain't the damnedest thing on two legs. Now, get back over here and let Sangreal help you. She held her arms wide, giving me a glorious view of her nude Nubian body. All that dark meat, just for me. And that was all it took. I couldn't control myself. Snarling like some wild animal, I lunged for her, snapping at her throat, at her breasts, at her belly. She artfully dodged my attacks with a grace that belied her age. All at once, I found myself pinned underneath her. That feral grin spread across her gorgeous face. Hold still, boy, she commanded. I writhed beneath her, struggling to get free, my jaws clenched in a desperate effort not to tear out her supple throat, until I was overpowered by the sensation of her wet puss lowering onto my cock. With a whimper, I fell still, savoring the experience of her, but afraid of what I might become if she let me run wild. Hang on, Peter, she whispered. This shouldn't take long. She rocked against me in a quick rhythm, stroking herself on the full length of my cock while managing to keep my arms and legs pinned under her. I realized then that she wasn't watching me. She was watching the television, or rather, the porn. The madam focused on the images that flitted across the screen, on the pounding flesh and bouncing breasts. She bucked against me faster, driving herself on my cock, all to the tune of some blonde getting her ass pummeled by a strap-on. Soon, a low groan met my ears. At the familiar sound of it, all of my craving for a quick, bloody meal fled straight to my prick. I fucked the madam in return, shoving myself into her, drawing another groan, then a growl as I repeated the process. The hunger cascaded down, shifting from my guts to my groin, until it lodged in my cock. I was no longer ravenous for just her flesh. I was starving for her orgasm. As if sensing the change, the madam let me free. I gathered her to me and held her tight, eager to feel her living skin against mine. She moaned as my fingers wandered her landscape, her face, her breasts, her ass. The madam pushed a nipple to my lips, seeking my tongue, maybe even my teeth, but I turned my head away. Sangreal thought you liked them, she pouted. I do, I said as I continued to thrust into her. I love them, I just don't trust myself. She narrowed her eyes at me. I smiled. I worry you might taste too good, and I wouldn't be able to stop at just a lick. It's the hunger, all right, she laughed aloud. You don't worry none. Sangreal know just what you need. She snatched one of my wandering hands and pushed it down between our writhing bodies, guiding it down. My fingers slipped past her dark thatch into her silken puss, landing square on her swollen nub, her clit. With a pretty good idea of what she wanted, thanks only to the porn industry, I wiggled my fingers against her. She groaned in response, and like a kid with a new toy, I rolled her over, excited to get at this sweet spot. She squealed when I touched her there again, raising her hips to meet my grazing fingers. Taking this as a good thing, I resumed my thrust while flicking my thumb across her sensitive pussy. Yes, Peter, she gasped. You learn fast. That feels so good. If it feels so good, I said, then why didn't you let me do this last night? She shuddered a little before she groaned. 'Cause it makes Sangreal come too fast. True to her words, she exploded in orgasmic light. I was awash in her beauty, her seduction shining in all the places we touched, bathing me, engulfing me, nurturing me, filling me. From somewhere, very far away, I heard her say, "Take it in, boy. Feed on it. It will soothe the hunger, the ache, the need." And it did. I'll be damned, but it did. The hunger subsided until it was all but forgotten, and as she came down from her high, dimming back into an ebony goddess, I was left with a full stomach and a smile on my face. Sighing in satisfaction, I stretched and wiggled my ever-present erection in her now very wet puss. "That was amazing," I said. The madam was limp beneath me, and at first I chalked it up to her first-rate orgasm. I was impressed by my newfound ability to make her come in seconds. It didn't take long for me to realize that she was out, quite literally, like a light. "Ma'am?" I asked as I poked her still form. She didn't respond. "Madame Sangreal?" I asked. No response. Rolling off of her, I got to my knees and patted her face a few times, repeating her name as I did. No luck. A quick check revealed that she hadn't joined me in the afterlife, but her vitals were as weak as water. The obvious reason leapt to mind. I had overworked the old girl. She might have the body of a 20-year-old, but she had the heart of an aged woman, a heart that I had just ran to its limits without a second thought. Ashamed at my selfishness, I lifted her from the floor, cradling her limp body to me as I carried her back to her room. There I placed her in the center of her bed and pondered what I should do next. Calling an ambulance seemed kind of crazy, and I wasn't sure I was in any state to greet people yet. I was just thinking that maybe all she needed was rest when she awoke. Her groan was music to my anxious mind. "Ma'am," I said, hovering over her, "are you okay?" Her eyelids fluttered a moment, then snapped open wide. She looked up at me with a touch of wonder on her face. "Peter." "Yes, ma'am?" "Get off me, boy." I obeyed. And she sat up, groggy but alive. Shaking her head, she eyed me. "How long was I out?" "A few minutes," I said. "What just happened?" "I think you took too much of me." I was afraid of that. "I'm sorry," I said. "Your true age is so hard to keep in mind. I forget you're more fragile than you look." She narrowed her eyes in dark bands of anger. "You calling me old, boy?" I swallowed hard, then lied. "No." "Good. Besides, it was my own fault. I should have explained first. I just thought showing you might be easier."
"Showing me? Are you full now?"
I rubbed my satisfied belly.
"Strangely enough, yes, I am."
All at once the meaning of her words sank in. The light, her orgasm, the hunger.
"I fed from you somehow. From your climax, didn't I?"
She nodded.
"You're a bright one, Peter."
"No, I'm not, because I don't understand how this is the same as, well, eating people." Sangreal chuckled, amused by my confusion. She laid back down, then patted the bed. I obediently curled up next to her, nestling my stiff cock against her warm thigh. Snuggling me up to her, she ran her hands through my hair as she tried to explain.
"When the living eats the dead, they take in nothing but minerals and vitamins and protein. Chemicals. Chains and chains of chemicals and nothing more."
"I think it's a bit more complex than that," I interjected. "Shut up and let me tell it my way," she snapped. I did.
"Now, when the dead feed from the flesh of the living, well, that's a whole nother beast. The dead don't need chemicals. They ain't using the ones they got. What they need instead is the essence. There's power in a person that flows through the very flesh. And that power is what the dead crave most. It's a life force. They stay hungry for it."
I nodded against her. "The hunger. It was horrible. I wanted to kill you. I wanted to tear you apart with my bare hands."
"Well, if the life force is the only thing that will sate the hunger, then how—"
"There is power in sex, child. Most folks will never know, understand, or even begin to fathom how much power. But this power, you've seen it."
"The light?" I asked.
"Yes. Most folks can't even sense the power, much less see it."
"Then why do I?"
She shrugged. "You must be a natural boy. I ain't never met a natural tantric. I heard rumors, but until now that's all it was, a rumor. Yet here you are, a natural."
A natural, I echoed. It was a heady thought. I had never been a natural at anything. The madam must have heard the conceit in my voice, because she stamped it right out. Yeah, but don't let it get to your head, boy. I may not be a natural, but I got lifetimes of experience to top you. She was right, of course, but she also sounded a little on this side of jealousy. I decided to drop the subject rather than test her mettle. So this power in sex, it's the same type of thing as the life force? It is the life force. Orgasm is the finest expression of life. You think about it, boy. Without the climax, there would be no life. I fell into a quiet awe at her statement. She was a strict mistress, but a wise one. At length I said, I think I understand. You're saying I can feed on the life force through other people's orgasms instead of consuming human flesh. She nodded again. I guess you had a taste of the force when I first brought you back, and now you're hooked on it. Only you got to learn to curb your appetite. You nearly drained me dry. I'm sorry, I said. I didn't even know what I was doing. Every lover dies a little when they come, she patted my head. That's a nice sentiment, but not every lover becomes a full-course meal. She laughed, once again soothing my jagged nerves. You'll get better at it. I'm sure of that much. You're just a cub yet. You learn to control that appetite for my honey, and this little bee can always make you more. Can you now? I asked, cupping her sex. And how long does that take? Because I like honey on just about everything. I emphasized my meaning with a quick flick of my tongue across her nipple. Don't be stupid, boy. Despite her rebuttal, she groaned as I slid a finger into her slick puss and grazed her clit. But before she groaned again, I realized what she had really said. I pulled away, sat up, and turned to stare down at her. Does that mean I can stay? For a little while, at least? She closed her eyes. I can't believe I'm saying this, but maybe.
Awesome! I said maybe. If we can solve your other little problem first.
My sinking dread returned. The rotting thing? The rotting thing. I sighed, racking my lifeless brain for suggestions, reaching for desperate measures. In the end, sarcasm won. I don't suppose this place has air conditioning. The madam opened her eyes to stare up at me as that mischievous smile crept over her crimson lips. That, my boy, is a very interesting idea. Very interesting indeed.
Made sure to buy
Library of the Living Dead is now proud to present Calvin A. L. Miller II's The Zombie Survival Guide, Thrive in the Zombie Apocalypse After You Turn, by Het Madden, from a zombie's perspective. Part 2. Is this going to hurt? What to expect from being bitten to your first kill? In short, yes, it's going to hurt, and like hell. Dying hurts, a lot, both physically and emotionally. You'll feel more pain than you've ever felt, pain that causes some to throw themselves off buildings or into oncoming traffic. But the pain can be soothed by feeding on healthies. Raw meat from any mammal will work, in fact, but the effects are much more temporary with animal meat. You need to feed on healthies. And don't worry, if you feed on a fellow dead accidentally, or on purpose, it won't kill you. In fact, it will happen. Frenzy is a phenomena that occurs under the right conditions when enough hungry deads are in a confined space, much like when locusts swarm, only we attack each other until something stops us, or we just stop. This will be covered more in a later part of this guide. But back to the pain. At first, you will feel like you have the flu, or a cold. You'll feel the need to rest, and a desire to be alone. As you begin to feel more and more ill, you will begin to vomit profusely, and experience an intestinal nausea like you've never felt, as you completely soil yourself. You will also run a very high fever, usually above 105 degrees Fahrenheit. Symptom of infection, vomiting. Some feel the moment they die, some don't. But we all know the moment we turn. It's a mix of fear and euphoria. The fear of death and the euphoria of being free from the chains of life. Almost immediately, hunger will burn inside you. You will try to eat normal food, but will throw it right back up. This will be confusing, but soon you'll realize what you truly crave. Then you'll find yourself around what you truly need, a healthy. At first, you'll feel nothing, really. You will simply see a person standing there. You will have smelled him and felt a strange longing or hunger. You'll walk up to him, and he will most likely be horrified by the sight of you. A word of warning. Be careful approaching healthies. Most are at least partially dangerous, especially those that are out among the population during the time of the apocalypse. They will be ready for a fight once the apocalypse has fully engaged, and will be looking to remove us and all of our ilk from the face of the earth. You know this because you either are or you were a healthy. Most likely, if you approach from the front, you'll be beaten with a blunt object or shot between the eyes. Normally, you'd expect help from your fellow man, but they do not help us once we turn. They kill us. When you get close enough to a healthy, however you manage this, the urge will come over you quickly. You will attack and feed uncontrollably, like your body is being guided by a force other than your own. You will ravenously attack and kill a human being, eating the cadaver before or after it dies, and any pain you felt before will be gone. Covered in flesh and blood from your kill, you most likely will not be able to stop until you're full or the corpse is fully eaten. This will disturb you emotionally, but you can't give in to those feelings. This is now your nature. Any religious views you have will come into the mix as well. How could God do this to us? To me, you may think. Well, He did. It was easy. And you have to get used to it. You will most likely devolve into a Class C dead. More on classes later. A typical zombie type, so quickly, it will be a struggle to think and reason. You will know you're having trouble too. You will feel less than you were and be angry you have to struggle to understand the environment around you. But you must soldier on and embrace what you have become. Trying to understand why this happened will only hold you back from realizing your full potential. Why does the wind blow? Why does the earth turn? They just do. Accept and embrace. Soon after you turn, you may experience several repercussions of death. Some of us experience rigor mortis, especially those who turn and do not keep moving. Moving keeps the dying tissue limber and the joints and muscles free from locking and stiffening. If you don't bleed out from the wounds received before or after you turn, blood will pool inside your body, and this will be governed by gravity. Stand upright and it will pull in your legs. Lie down and it will pull towards the ground. The best way to fix this is to slice a hole in the area of the blood pooling to release it. The pain from the pooling blood can range from none at all to a cold burning sensation that is nearly unbearable and only assuaged by getting all the offending blood removed at once. When cutting to create an escape for the painful and now completely useless fluid, you must be careful not to slice through muscle or tendons. Because you no longer heal, any damage you do will be permanent and will severely limit your mobility. You are dead, remember? If you can take the pulling, it's best to just leave it alone. You will invariably be wounded in the near future, and the blood will come out sooner or later. Stay tuned next episode, good librarians, for the third part of Calvin A. L. Miller II's The Zombie Survival Guide, and learn, how smart will I be, how strong will I be? Will I be me, and will I be the kind of bastard that eats families? This book available on Amazon.com. Please buy a copy today and support Calvin and his writing endeavors.
Zombies all around. Zombies all around. Zombies.
Library of the Living Dead is now proud to present Lazarus by Lori Titus. Part 1. Lazarus, California, 1869. Luella arrived in town with one trunk and a suitcase. The trip had been a long one. The train stopped two cities away, and from there she rode a coach up to Lazarus. The town was small. A church, a city hall, a sheriff's station, a few stores, including a bakery and a commissary, the saloon and hotel set further back from the street, the windows dark beneath the shutters drawn tight against the blanching desert heat. Luella entered a small dark building and leaned over the counter to speak to the man behind it. "May I speak to the sheriff?" The deputy, a man named Sully, roused himself from his daydreaming and blinked. The woman wore a fine, pale blue dress and matching hat. As hot as the afternoon was, he didn't see a bead of sweat on her. She regarded him coolly, her brown eyes narrowing as his stare slipped from her face to the swell of her décolletage.
Miss, can I help you? Sully asked. If you're here to report a crime, then I'm the man you need to speak with.
She smiled. No, sir, that's not why I'm here. I have specific business in which the sheriff will take an interest.
Business? From a woman? He muttered under his breath. Well, have a seat, ma'am.
She stared at him for a moment, and seeing no other choice, took a seat in the corner. Sheriff Drake didn't come back into the office until a little past 12. He saw the young woman sitting in a chair, playing with a timepiece in her palm.
Miss? He said.
She snapped the timepiece shut and looked up at him. Are you Sheriff Drake?
Yes, I am, ma'am. And you are Miss...
Mrs., she corrected. Luella Pembry. Have you been waiting long? He asked. Her eye flashed over at Sully, who pretended to read paperwork on the desk in front of him.
No, sir, not at all, she replied.
Well, please come into my office and we can discuss whatever it is you need. The sheriff's office was cramped. The desk seemed to take up most of the space in the room. The window behind the desk was open, but the air that sifted in was hot. Sitting across the desk from him, Luella was aware of just how close the space was. The sheriff was a tall man with black hair and dark eyes. He had a cleft chin and olive skin. He grinned, and the expression lit his eyes.
"You'll have to excuse Sully," Drake said. "His manner could be better. I was a few doors down talking with one of the shop owners. I'd have come if I'd known you were waiting. Are you settling here in Lazarus?"
"That's my intention," she replied. "Then your husband will be joining you?"
"No, he won't. I'm a widow."
"Well, I'm sorry for your loss, ma'am. Is his passing recent?"
"Somewhat. It's been a little over a year."
She paused. "I've come here to get a new start."
"You have relatives nearby?"
"No, which is part of the reason I came to California."
"Well, I do suppose family can be both blessing and curse.
So what brings you here to see me, Mrs. Pembry?" She sat back in her chair, staring out the window. Luella paused before looking back at Drake. "My husband was a wealthy man. I'd like to buy property here in Lazarus. I'm told that, even with the means to buy, it's very difficult for a lady like myself to secure land on her own. I was also told that certain exceptions could be made, and that you're the man with whom I need to speak."
"Mrs. Pembry, I do sympathize, but the town's laws are what they are. I hope you're not suggesting..."
"What I am suggesting is that I can be of service to you and your town, and once my services are provided, I'd like to purchase a plot of land here to build my own house, in my name."
"Services? What could that be?"
"Sheriff Drake, the train's been coming to Roseville for a few years now. That's a stone's throw from here. By all rights, your town should be prospering. The old families stay, but new ones don't come. There is a reason for that."
"Mrs. Pembry, I don't recall your saying exactly where you're from."
"You don't recall because I didn't tell you. My husband and I lived in Boston. That's where he was born, but I'm from Louisiana."
"Then how is it that you think you know so much about Lazarus?"
"I don't think.
I know. She leaned forward in her chair, her voice dropping to a whisper. He could smell the scent of rosewater on her skin. You and I both know that people were afraid to stay in this town, and for good reason. Since you know all about the local folklore, Drake spat, let's talk plainly about it then. What is it you're getting at? You've got a problem keeping the dead in their graves here, she said, and I can help you. Drake stared at her. A moment elapsed, and they were both silent. How did you come to hear of our local folklore? He pressed. People say things. I listen. It's not as well kept a secret as you and Mayor Cole think that it is. Mayor Cole? Jasper thinks that he knows everything. So do you. It's one of those things you have in common, but as of late, it's happening more often, isn't it? The dead are restless. Who are you? Drake asked. Who are you really? That's not the right question. Then what are you? She stood. When she smiled, the expression did not touch her eyes. Certainly, Sheriff Drake, you can figure that out on your own. Jasper Cole lived alone in the largest house in town. His ancestors had been the original settlers of the town of Lazarus, and had grown wealthy handling the trading business that had passed down from his father. With trains speeding across the country, business had never been better. His brothers and sisters had all moved north, and he was the last Cole to remain in Lazarus. He was sitting in his study reading when there was a knock on the door. "What do you want?" he snapped. The last person he had expected to see at such a late hour was Benjamin Drake. Ben gave him a snarl of a smile. "Since when do you answer your own door? The maid leaves before sundown. Come on in." "I'd like a drink," the sheriff said. "With what I've got to tell you, you're going to need one, too." Over whiskey, Benjamin Drake recounted his story of meeting Luella Pembry. When he was done, Jasper looked at him with a raised eyebrow. "Well, you didn't admit anything to the woman, did you?" "Have you been listening? She already knew about the dead rising." "Well, you're the law here. What do you intend to do about her?" "It seems to me she's more than just my problem. Besides, she thinks she can help. Why not let her have a hand at it? If she fails, then we run her out of town." "She has suspicions about us, then? About who we are?" "That's my guess. She wants to meet with you as well, tomorrow night." "How did my name come up in the conversation?" Benjamin smiled. "She brought it up, with mention of your singular sense of stubbornness." "You trust this woman?" "I'm not sure. I'd like to see what it is she thinks she can do." Jasper chuckled. "Tell me something. Is she pretty? Do you fancy her?" "You can judge her beauty for yourself when you meet her tomorrow night. I'll bring her by for dinner." "You do like her," Jasper said, taking another gulp of his whiskey. "That's why you're entertaining this hogwash. She's probably soft in the head." "Well, that said, I'll bring her by at 6 o'clock. "You do that," Jasper said. His eyes were watery. It was obvious the drink had the better of him. Ben wondered if his friend would even remember their conversation the next morning. "Sounds almost like the old days," Jasper said, his eyes far away. "It will never be like the old days with Sarah," Ben answered. He regretted his words as soon as he spoke, but there was no way to take them back. Jasper sobered, a coldness settling into his eyes. "I'll see you tomorrow, Drake. Now get out of my house." The town's only inn was called the Lazarus Arms. The elderly couple who ran the inn were pleased to have a new guest. Nancy, the wife, informed Luella that she'd made more money selling lunches to railroad workers and renting out rooms. Because Luella was her only guest, the proprietress offered her the best room in the establishment. The room was of modest size, with faded green wallpaper and a hard bed, but the room boasted its own bath. Nancy heated the water for her bath, but Luella insisted on hauling the pots to the room herself. The elderly woman was frail, and Luella hated to think of Nancy losing her balance while carrying the hot water. The bath was worth the trouble. Luella sank gratefully into the claw-footed tub. She leaned back, closing her eyes. It had been an entire week since she had slept properly. The steamy water lulled the small aches and pains she had acquired over the length of her trip. She was floating, drifting. Behind her eyelids, she saw blackness. The sound came out of nowhere, loud enough that it seemed to be right next to her. She could feel the vibrations of it against her face. Scratching. Luella opened her eyes and got out of the tub. She knew the sound and what it meant all too well. She put on her gown, sitting at the foot of the bed. She hesitated only a moment before opening her trunk. Inside was a wooden casing roughly the size of a book. Luella lifted the lid and gazed at the workings of the device inside. The gold dials were encased inside a layer of glass. The spokes moved in steady, slow circles. She breathed a sigh of relief. If the machine had picked up on any activity, the tiny spokes would have spun wildly in a counterclockwise motion. Luella sighed in relief and shut the device away. She should be safe. The undead were not stalking her tonight. Yet she'd heard the sound, the scratching. There was nothing quite like it, the sound of bone against wood, the mindless repetition. Marcus was the one that put his faith in science. In this device, she thought grimly. And where had that gotten him? She shook her head. There had been other nights when she was sure that they would have come for her. And somehow, she made it through until morning, untouched. She inched backwards until she was sitting against the headboard. It was all too much. She was going to have to sleep. If they came, then they took her. If I die, she thought, then maybe I will be with Marcus, the last person who loved me. Maybe death is a better fate than being left behind with a monster. Luella didn't stay awake long. She slept sitting up, with a gun at her side, just in case the device in the wooden box had failed her for the second time. Stay tuned next episode, Good Librarian, for more of Lori Titus, Lazarus. And that's it, good librarians, for episode number 120 of Library of the Living Dead. Stay tuned next time for a new letter, Lucky Stiff, Chapter 3, Part 1, The Zombie Survival Guide by Calvin Miller, and Part 2 of Lazarus by Lori Titus. There'll be a bunch of other stuff, too. Sorry for the short podcast, but it's been since November since I got one out, and an hour is pretty good time. So, I hope you enjoyed the show, and as like we always do, we're going to go out with a song!
It was a zombie jamboree, took place in the New York cemetery. It was a zombie jamboree, took place in the New York cemetery. Zombies from all parts of the island, some of them were great Calypsonians. Since the season was carnival, they got together in Bacchanal, and they were singing back to back, belly to belly. I don't give a damn, cause I done dead already. Oh, back to back, belly to belly. A zombie jamboree, one female zombie, she won't behave. See how she's dancing out of the grave. In one hand she's holding a quart of rum, the other hand is knocking a conga drum. You know the lead singer starts to make his rhyme, while the other zombie's rocking in time. One by standing there, he had this to say. It was a trip to see the zombies break away. And they were singing back to back, belly to belly. I don't give a damn, cause I done dead already. Oh, back to back, belly to belly. A zombie jamboree. And they were singing back to back, belly to belly. Now I don't give a damn, cause I done dead already. Oh, back to back, belly to belly. A zombie jamboree. Liberty, uptown, downtown, zombie jamboree. Zombie, 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 yeah, yeah. There's an acapella zombie singing down Broadway. A King Kong zombie on the Empire State. But the biggest zombies, Tokyo to Rome. The zombies who call this city home.